I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, 2020 Democratic Party presidential hopeful Tulsi Gabbard has announced that she is dropping out of the race and endorsing Joe Biden. Before dropping out of the race, however, Tulsi managed to really capture a certain segment of the progressive left that felt she was the only or most sufficiently anti-war candidate. Others, however, have argued that Tulsi's anti-war posturing is actually a cover for America First style nationalism. That is not exactly far removed from the ideas of someone like, say, Steve Bannon of Breitbart and Trump White House fame. Now, to be perfectly honest, I am very skeptical of Tulsi Gabbard and have had guests on who are extremely critical of her, including Samira Khan, Robbie Martin, and Albert Lanier. I've also had at least two guests who are more supportive of Gabbard on the program, namely Professor Richard Drake and Senator Mike Gravel. On this edition of the program, a surrogate for the Tulsi Gabbard campaign, Nico House, joins us to explain why he supported the presidential effort of Tulsi Gabbard. Now, most of Nico's appearances on other programs are debate-based in nature. For example, Nico has debated left media figures like Cool James Cash of GNN and, more recently, Ben Burgess, both of whom have also appeared on Parallax Views. This appearance, however, is a bit different for Nico. I wasn't interested in a straightforward debate, but rather a discussion. I wanted to give Nico a chance to say his piece, and although I do voice some of the concerns I have about Tulsi Gabbard, I basically gave Nico a chance to make his argument for why progressives should have put more of their weight behind the Tulsi Gabbard campaign. I do voice some of my concerns, mainly in regards to Tulsi's courting of what, in my view, are conservative right-wing nationalists whose anti-war stances are informed not by a desire for peace and a more cooperative internationalism abroad. I think that progressives aligning themselves with this element could backfire. Now that's just my view. I allow Nico to address that. We also talk a little near the end of the conversation about India and the controversies around Tulsi Gabbard and Indian Prime Minister Modi. Now, I argue that, in fact, I find Tulsi's desires for U.S.-Indian relations to actually be in line with the establishment, or at least the mainstream of American thought, and I remain uncomfortable with that because of what is currently going on in Kashmir. That's my view, but I allow Nico to make his case. We also talk about a number of other things, the accusations of Tulsi being a Russian agent, and much more. My sometimes co-host Casey joined us for this conversation, but he takes on a more minimalistic role. With all that being said, on to my conversation with Nico House on why he supported the Tulsi Gabbard campaign. Welcome to Parallax Views. Nico House, a big supporter of the Tulsi Gabbard campaign, also a progressive activist, I would say. Nico, how are you doing? And maybe if you can give my listeners a bit of your background as an activist.
Yeah, so I appreciate you having me on, first of all. I was actually a surrogate for Tulsi Gabbard's 2020 campaign. I was formerly the president and founder of Carolina Students for Bernie Sanders, and I was the president of North Carolina Colleges for Bernie. And then I was also the state director until about three or four weeks before the 2016 campaign's the North Carolina primary. So, you know, a pretty big organizing background. I worked with Tim Canova as well. you know, I've spoken at several events and all that good stuff, but also does some strategy too behind the scenes for congressional campaigns and presidential campaigns alike. Also, obviously, I have my own show, Mikasa Sukasa, and I have my own media network as well for politics and other things like that. It's called the MCSE Network. And we started the DNC fraud lawsuit from 2016. I founded it with Jarrett and Elizabeth Lee Beck, which is actually still ongoing, by the way. It's pretty much the gist of it. Pretty busy.
and just out of curiosity, I know I have to mention it because I've been mentioning it with every other guest. How are you doing with the quarantine and all this craziness about coronavirus right now?
It's real. You know, my family's been affected by it as well. My wife is laid off of work because of it. Luckily, you know, she has health care, because that was the reason why they laid everybody off. They didn't want anybody not using, or they didn't want anybody using their health care without working, so they just fired everybody. It's messed up, I know, but you know, it's the reality. I'm better off than I would think a lot of people are, though, so I'm counting my blessings in that department. But you know, we're healthy. My family's, so far, they've all reported back being healthy, and hopefully it stays that way.
I wanted to ask too, because I assumed someone was going to go after this conversation and say, oh, I bet Nico doesn't believe in coronavirus. I know some people have said you're prone to conspiracy theories. I'm not saying that. I'm curious. I've just heard that.
I don't know why I wouldn't believe in coronavirus. I mean, I believe in the flu. I mean, don't get me wrong. Do I question certain aspects about it? Yeah. I mean, I feel like once you delve into politics deep enough, if you're doing good journalism, you should be questioning the intentions behind everything that happens. You know, when you have the Democrats introducing a stimulus package and the Republicans introducing a stimulus package, and people made it, you know, Democrat versus Republican, not realizing they were both trying to bail out the corporations. But on one side of the fence, they pretended that it was only Republicans. And the other side, the Republicans pretended like they just didn't, the Democrats didn't want to give any stimulus whatsoever. So you always have to ask questions about the intentionality behind a lot of these things, you know, and how some people will use pandemics for their own personal gain. But I mean, if that makes me a conspiracy theorist, then I guess.
No. I don't think that's conspiratorial at all. In fact, I would say that right now we're seeing almost an even bigger corporate takeover of America through these stimulus packages. It just seems like a bailout for the ultra rich.
It absolutely seems like that. And it's even worse because if you understand like what the bailout is supposed to be for, how the stock market works and what corporations have been known to do with their money, you know, we always have a recession about every 10 or 12 years. But the reality is, it looks a lot different than what it's looked like recently. The recession now, instead of people losing their homes, you know, they get three or four people per room to keep the rent and the mortgage paid off. Or, you know, you yourself will have a roommate instead of living by yourself like they used to back in the day. Nobody is really being forced out where you have this clear cut and dry, you no longer have a job, you no longer have a place to stay. And then of course we know that the corporations will use that money that they get bailed out with in buybacks. And then this ultra rich will then buy up the property, buy up those houses, buy up the goods, and then resell them, you know, and make is more profit than they were making before the recession. Now it's different because, well, the recession didn't really do that. It didn't just put everybody out on their asses, so to speak. And so now you're seeing the corporations almost try to take advantage of the fact that like, okay, we don't even know if we're going to be able to have an opportunity to capitalize on the recession like we've had so many other times. So let's just go ahead and tell them we're going to have major losses. This is going to be a problem, even though we don't have a time frame yet, right? But corporations are asking for money that they could potentially lose, which we know they're going to just use in corporate buybacks. Now, that doesn't benefit us in any way. In fact, it benefits them almost exclusively because what happens? Their stocks are extremely low because of this virus. So they're buying their own stock at an all-time low rate. And of course, all Trump has to do is basically snap his fingers. And whether or not we like it, people will be back to work. People will be back to buying from these small businesses and these corporations. And it'll be back to normal and their stocks will skyrocket again. So they just made money from potential bailouts for potential losses they haven't even had yet. And once again, you know, the people are for the most part left to fend for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to note, I hope I didn't confuse you when I mentioned conspiracy theories, because I know when I was reading up on you, there were people saying that you didn't believe in like certain mass shootings or you had alternative theories. So I didn't know what your take on the conspiracy theory subject was.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people say a lot of things about me. It's part mm-hmm. of the gig, but there's not a mass shooting that I think didn't happen. I mean, I don't know why people would say that.
Fair enough.
The most conspiratorial thing I've ever said about a mass shooting in my recollection is this. I actually quoted the Las Vegas Police Department regarding some aspect of the Las Vegas shooting. Like I did a video covering that. And it was about something the Las Vegas Police Department had put out in their blotter or something to that degree. That's probably the most conspiratorial I've gotten as far as that's concerned.
Fair enough. I just wanted to get that out of the way and let you clarify on those matters. So with regards to Tulsi, how are you feeling about Tulsi announcing that she's dropped out of the race?
You know, obviously I'm disappointed because, for those of you who don't know, she was going to stay into the convention, and she was viable to stay into the convention, believe it or not. She was still filling up rooms of anywhere between 300 to 600 people. She was still meeting her donations quotas. And you know, she was getting her voice out there and getting, unfortunately, CNN and MSNBC won't touch her. But, you know, she was still getting out there on Fox News and she was having plenty of people come to her defense over being kept off the debate stage. And so it was sad that this coronavirus situation almost forced her hand because that's the only reason she dropped out. It wasn't necessarily because she wanted to. I think that at this point, we know the DNC would not allow her to be the nominee, even if she was doing better than she is or she was doing before she dropped out. But, you know, so the coronavirus really has put a damper on a lot of things. Killed the campaign and killed the NBA. Like, I was just devastated. It happened like the same week, damn near. So a little heartbreaking. But, you know, the thing I'm most saddened about, though, is that the policies that she advocated for, the legislation that she introduced and was going to reintroduce as president, you know, they won't really come into fruition, and there's not going to be a major presidential candidate talking about it. Her Securing America's Elections Act, which would have made it mandatory for all federal elections to be, one, the voting machines that would be used have to be open source blockchain. Then, of course, you have the mandatory voter verified paper ballots and paper ballot backups in addition to the blockchain technology. And then money allocated to these, you know, these different state governors to make sure it can happen. That won't be talked about by any other presidential candidates. We're still pretending like these exit polls are normal. Like, it's normal for one party to have completely like sporadic exit polling differences between the candidates, what they were supposed to do versus what they actually did. In the Republican Party, they perfectly matched down the line two elections in a row. You know, that's something that needs to be discussed, isn't going to be discussed, unfortunately. Look at the All Fossil Fuels Act, why everybody was saying that climate change can't wait. Tulsi introduced legislation in 2017 to deal with climate change in a very substantive way that was more far-reaching than the Green New Deal. It was approved by 400 climate and environmental organizations. No other legislation in history, no other climate change legislation in history can boast that. That's something, unfortunately, that will not be considered by the presidential candidates. And that was a bill already in the House. You look at Julian Assange's situation and the situation for whistleblowers. No one else will come to the aid of whistleblowers to the degree that Tulsi Gabbard did. So all these key issues that don't just deal with the Band-Aid, you know, the Band-Aid stuff that we often hear about. It isn't, you know, soundbite-ish. It isn't the sexy issue, but these are issues that affect our livelihood, you know, our liberties and things like that, nonetheless. And of course, with climate change, you're looking at an existential crisis that Tulsi tried to address while all the other Democrats were saying, you know, climate change can't wait. Then why is it that all out of all those Democrats on that stage, the only one who had a bill that was an extensive overhaul of everything, not only just how we deal with pollution and things like that, but also what do you do with the economy afterwards? She was the only one with a bill addressing that before she even thought about running for president, and then subsequently reintroduced when she did. So those are the things that I'm going to miss the most, not necessarily Tulsi running, but the fact that we're not going to have anyone addressing once again the structural issues, the fundamental structural issues, before we can even get to talking about Medicare for All. Like, we can't get Congress people like Ilhan Omar and AOC or Rashida Tlaib, et cetera, we can't get them in place all over the country whenever even Bernie, who by every legitimate metric should be obliterating Joe Biden. But what people don't discuss is the fact that all these new states or all these states that Bernie all of a sudden either lost when he destroyed Hillary, or it became way too close in a situation where it should have never been close. All those states replaced their old, either replaced their caucuses with new voting machines, their old voting machines with new, more hackable voting machines, or their paper ballots with voting machines with no paper ballot backups. That's the conversation we need to be having. And unfortunately, because Tulsi isn't in the race, we won't be having them anymore.
Well, I think those policy concerns are really great. Just as a full disclosure on my end, I have been, I've had guests on that have been critical of Tulsi, people like Robbie Martin, Ben Burgess. I've also had one or two guests that were really supportive of Tulsi, Professor Richard Drake and Mike Gravel. So I'm curious, aside from maybe my views on Tulsi and whatnot, I want to know, so you start out as a Bernie supporter in 2016. Why in 2020 did you back Tulsi? I'm curious what led to the change there.
So initially I supported, and I still, by the way, I've never stopped supporting Bernie, but I was just supporting both of them. And I was even talking to both campaigns pretty frequently, giving advice wherever I could, and helping out on the ground wherever I could. But although I still supported both, it was really Tulsi dealing with and addressing the issues, fighting that fight that seemingly no one else, at least at that, with that, at that level, with that type of platform, wanted to fight. Seeing that genuine evolution that we've asked so many of our politicians to experience, that some politicians pretend like they experience. You know, that bravery that it took for her to leave the vice presidential position, or vice presidential, excuse me, vice chairwoman position at the DNC, you know, specifically on the grounds that they were cheating Bernie Sanders just by, you know, limiting the debates compared to what they had been in the past. And then, of course, subsequently, not even capitalizing as much as building upon that, then going to Syria. She tried to end the war, by the way, in Syria in 2015. She introduced legislation to do something about it. No one talked about it. Then she goes to Syria in 2017 to figure out exactly what's happening on the ground. And amazingly enough, she got to talk to people on both sides. She got to talk to the people who were being most affected by it. And I encourage anybody to go look at the videos on YouTube. They're tearjerkers. So be prepared for that. But I think everybody should see it. It takes bravery to do that. And then to subsequently come out, you know, as the years went on and introduced the No More Presidential Wars Act, doing everybody else was more mad, seemingly, that Trump was exercising, you know, war crimes that he really had no, he didn't have authority over Congress to initiate, but Tulsi actually was introducing legislation to make sure that he didn't only get away with it with, when it came to Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen, or all these other little proxies, Syria. She introduced legislation to hold him accountable immediately the moment that he messes up. It's called the No More Presidential Wars Act. You know, Stop Arming and Stop Financing Terrorists Act. That was big for me because not only are you obviously stopping the arming of these terrorist organizations and the financing of them by the U.S. government, but in order for you to acknowledge that, you have to be brave enough to say something and acknowledge something that many people kind of know, but no official was willing to come out and admit, because then of course you could be attacked by the military industrial complex, and of course she was. So once again, it's these type of issues that really have a huge effect on anything that domestically that either Tulsi or Bernie wants to introduce. And until we really deal with those, I just didn't see any of the other stuff we wanted to see done coming into fruition. And so ultimately, I felt like and Tulsi had a progressive message that was beyond talking points. You know, of course, her movement was nowhere near as big as Bernie's. And I still have a great deal of respect for what Bernie has helped create. But her movement was still significant and still impactful and still had a lot of crossover, because I'm also on, you know, just being involved in politics. I know that conservatives and liberals and progressives and populists, we all have much more in common than a lot of people think we do. But even more so, if you want to see any of this stuff pass, like Medicare for All, you know, like the Securing America's Elections Act, Green New Deal, what have you, it's going to take all of us to have an understanding. And a lot of the conservatives, they won't even bring themselves into a room to hear out our policies unless that they have a person they can believe in that's authentic. And Tulsi has, for whatever reason, been able to do that and bring progressives, conservatives, liberals, populists all in the same room, have listen to what she says, and they leave usually converted. So you know, that's the message. Not only that's the message in the type of campaigns I would like to see, not only in 2020 but going forward as well.
Well, I want to get more into Tulsi and her policies and maybe some of the criticisms, but I want to ask you first, since you said you were a surrogate, there's a lot of talk lately. I guess Tulsi's brother came out and was criticizing the Bernie campaign, claiming that the Sanders campaign didn't reach out enough to Tulsi for a
the original claim was. So the original claim that was made by Jai, who was her brother, right, was that Tulsi had reached out repeatedly to the campaign, and the campaign refused her endorsement. Now,
right, an endorsement, yeah.
I cannot say, unfortunately, whether or not that was factual or not. All I can say is what Tulsi said, which is that she did reach out to the campaign. They've had their own conversations, you know, recently, but those conversations would remain private. So that's the only thing she said about that.
Okay, fair enough. And I also want to note, I know that a lot of Tulsi's critics, and I've been critical at times, and we can talk about that, but a lot of people have criticized Tulsi for coming out and endorsing Biden. The thing is, Bernie may end up endorsing Biden as well. So I'm not sure that we should criticize her for that necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. Bernie's going to, and I would say that until very, very recently, Bernie was going to drop out. Within the few days of Tulsi dropping out. But thing is, Biden is not looking so hot. So Bernie could end up being the nominee by default. However, if he decides to suspend the campaign, and then of course Biden would subsequently pick a VP, then that VP would end up becoming the nominee almost by default, because they'll make the argument that, oh, you know, if something really does happen to Biden, well, this is the person that Biden nominated to be his successor. This is the one who he felt was most equipped to be the nominee and be the president potentially. So that's who we're going to go with. And that will be their excuse, which we don't want to really give them that opportunity. So it would make it much more difficult for them to do something like that if Bernie just stays in and waits for Biden to essentially off himself politically, because that's what's basically been happening. It's been scary to see. It's almost abusive, I think, at this point to keep him in. Like, I'm not even joking. People are like are laughing about this, but like, let that man live out his last years in peace. I'm not. This stress is probably speeding up whatever cognitive decline that he had. You know, it's one thing to continue to work and feel useful, but he can do that from behind the scenes. He does not need to do that with the weight of the world on his shoulders. And when you look at how Bernie carries himself, how he responds, how sharp he is, how active he is, compared to Biden, and they're the same age. What, I think Biden's a few, maybe older or a little bit younger.
I think he's 76, I think Bernie is 78. Yeah.
I don't even think that. I think the difference is actually smaller than that. I think it's like maybe months, like six or 7 months. Yeah. And when you look at the fact that Bernie's older and he seems to be much more responsive and much more articulate, and he doesn't have those gaffes that that Biden has, could you imagine when they were trying to criticize the Democrats, the neoliberals, they were throwing out that Trump wasn't even capable of running the country because of the few incidents we may see him slip up here or there. And now we have them throwing Joe Biden down our throat, and we have a perfectly good Bernie Sanders right beside him, who's infinitely more popular, who has much more popular policies. And out of the candidates still left in the race, the only one who I believe can beat Trump. So, but Biden needs to go somewhere. But Bernie will probably endorse him eventually. I hope that it's not anytime soon at this juncture. But you're correct. Tulsi, you know, she didn't say exactly, but she knows that Biden is fortunately going to be the nominee unless anything major happens. And she wanted to kind of wipe her hands of the election. Mm-hmm. And the reality of the situation is, if she would have endorsed Bernie, knowing, you know, she said her conversations were private, but I want to be like realistic, right? There was probably some talk of Bernie dropping out in that conversation, because she had talked to him right before she decided to drop out. And if she would have endorsed him again, there's already been not really any net benefit for her endorsing him in 2016. And we can get into that later. But endorsing him again would utterly sink her with the establishment. And he hasn't really repaid that support she showed him in 2016. So that wouldn't, you know, it wasn't like she would be a saving grace in the progressive movement as well, because if he would drop out very soon after, then what happens to her? I think that it's, you know, first of all, let me just say, I don't agree with either of them endorsing Biden. I would have just kept it to myself, but I do understand they both signed a contract. And for Tulsi, if she wants to run again in the future for a presidential nomination, she can't.
Do you know how those contracts work? I'm just curious, like, are they like legally binding? Do they get in trouble if they don't
follow
them?
They're not legally binding, but because the Democratic Party is a private nonprofit corporation, if their charter says one thing, and then it's, you know, any contract with the Democratic Party, for example, if you don't abide by it, you know, we can punish you however we see fit. And then they present a contract to you, and then you don't abide by it. No, you couldn't be sued. No, you couldn't, you know, you couldn't lose your like house seat. But when it's time to run for president, the Democratic Party could say, well, you can run, but you can't run under this banner. You can't use any of our services. you can't, you know, you won't be able to speak at this debate sponsored by the Democratic Party, and basically make it so that you would never be seen even more so than what she was dealing with now. So, and Bernie was in an even more unique situation because as a Vermonter, you can't register for a political party. You can only register to vote, and you're, you know, you can align yourself with the political party, but there are no private political parties. And, you know, there are people who identify as Democrat, they do their business. People identify as Republican, they do their businesses, they do their business, but they're doing them as individuals, not as a, you know, a sanctioned nonprofit 501c4 mixed with a C3 type of party situation. So he could be completely disallowed to run in anything Democratic. Even they could even stop him from being part of the Democratic caucus, maybe, if they choose to, if he violated the contract. So that's why I've always been a little bit more forgiving. I'm a policy-based type of person, not personality. I like seeing patterns where you were constantly fighting that fight, tackling those issues. If you make a slip up, like I'm not a, so I like Ayanna Pressley. I think she's a really good example. She pissed me off when she endorsed Elizabeth Warren when she did. Because everything she actually supports in Congress is really was really supported by Bernie, if you were going to choose between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. But because she's in Massachusetts, because I think, you know, she has a career to think about too. Mm-hmm. And because I know that when Bernie introduces something, she'll vote for it, right? That's how I feel about Ayanna. No, am I happy with her not endorsing a progressive? No, but does that mean I'm going to just completely shred her and call her a neoliberal because she's made one or two missteps? No, I think that there are levels, you know, I think that there's a spectrum. And just because someone does one good thing doesn't mean they're super progressive. But just because someone does one bad thing or one slip up for their career, just, you know, a couple of things. It's not like a pattern that's been expressed, but just a couple of things here or there. That doesn't mean they're not a progressive either. I think we have to be a little bit more careful and observe policy positions over time to determine whether or not someone is an ally or not.
Another thing, and I'm going to kick it over to you, Casey, in a second, but I also want to get this out of the way real quick. Another thing I've at least been sympathetic with Tulsi supporters on is that these smears, especially from the Hillary Clinton camp, claiming mm-hmm. she's a Russian agent, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, to be honest, I think in 2014, she was actually a bit hawkish on Russia, saying that, you know, we needed to push back on Russia in the Ukraine. So I feel that the accusations of her being a Russian agent are just unfounded and wrongheaded. And even I think Beto O'Rourke and other candidates said that. I think Andrew Yang said, no, she's not a Russian agent.
Yeah. Yeah. Bernie, Andrew. So for the record, it was Andrew Yang was the first to defend her. Marianne Williamson came and defended her as well. Nina Turner came out and spoke almost immediately to defend her. You know, Bernie came out about a day or so later. Everybody kind of realized like this is kind of, like there were some, even Van Jones was like, if you're going to make a charge like that, you better be prepared to defend that in court. And, you know, if you're a legislator, like because Kamala was even making suggestions like that. And Kamala's in the Senate. And, you know, damn well, if she was on the Armed Services Committee, Tulsi still is on the Armed Services Committee, but she was also formerly a part of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And you have to have a top secret clearance to get that. And they know that she also has to have at least a secret clearance for her position in the National Guard, at least bare minimum. So, and at least a secret clearance to be on the Armed Services Committee. So you don't think that that would have come up at some point, you know, if she was a Russian agent? And it's frustrating because then I was telling people, you know, and it's not just that situation, but a lot of these situations where they tried to illegitimately smear her. Like if this can happen to Tulsi, you know who's coming next. They're eliminating the lowest hanging fruit at the moment. But once they feel like she's no longer a threat, they will move on. And it will be to Bernie. It will be to even an Andrew Yang. I know, you know, we're not too fond of him right now because of what he did. But, you know, even a Marianne Williamson. It, you know, Bernie's the hardest, the furthest target, but he's still a target. And what do we see happen? Immediately, once they feel like they got everybody else out the race and it was time to kind of put the screws to Bernie, that article came out, oh, Russians may be helping Bernie Sanders' campaign. And then Tulsi was actually the only presidential candidate to come out with an op-ed in The Hill and completely debunk it and then directly call out the intelligence community for trying to interfere in the elections. Like I said, when you ask me what am I going to miss about Tulsi running, it's things like that, because she came out to defend Bernie. She came out to call out the intelligence community. And it wasn't just some good things are good, bad things are bad nonsense. It was, I know what you're doing. It's dangerous and you need to stop it. That's this type of, you know, the type of fervor that we need, not only just as president, but that's the those are the conversations that we have to be unafraid to have. And I think that Tulsi was one of the only ones willing to do so.
What exactly are Tulsi's sort of policy ideas with concerns to not only Russia, but I'm curious what her policies are with regards to China, because a lot of people say Trump is the one that's aggressive with China, but really it's also DC consensus that is very aggressive. And in some ways, I think we're at a dangerous precipice with that.
Yeah, man, the China situation is really weird. But like the moment that Donald Trump started cheering on the Hong Kong protesters, I was like, hold up. Bring it back. There must be something going on. And then we found out that a lot of the stuff going on there was CIA backed. So, you know, the Chinese government is not altruistic in any way. You know, I'm not going to say they're the most evil things walking the planet, because like, look who's running our country, a bunch of sociopaths. But at the same token, I know that they kind of Chinese government is almost overcompensates and hyperreacts because they know how we are and how much propaganda we put out, not only about, you know, for our country, but about or against other nations. And well, we lie about China quite often, to be real with you. And so Tulsi's position on China seems to be pretty measured. She understands that just by, you know, just the natural order of things at the moment, China is somewhat of an economic threat. But they also are, we're like in a symbiotic economic relationship with China as well. So you have to deal with, you know, we still benefit from them and we benefit from each other and we almost need each other to survive. And so I think her approach with China has just been taken one step at a time and put ourselves in a position to negotiate bilaterally with China rather than trying to do, like, it seems like everything we do from our country standpoint is either we take over your government, we completely delegitimize your government or the leader in charge that we don't like, or we invade your country. Those are usually, or we just won't work with you at all and we'll try to punish everybody else who does work with you. Whereas China has figured out, why would I need to do that, even though they have a way bigger army than us, you know, just by population size. But they don't need to do that. Why? Because take, for example, the lithium triangle situation with Chile, I think it's Argentina and Bolivia. They have almost 100% control over that area as far as foreign countries are concerned because of bilateral agreements. They have a lot of the market in Africa now. They didn't have to colonize these African countries to do that. It was through bilateral trade agreements. They benefit to a degree. The Africans in those countries benefit as well. Not as much as they should, I might add, but you know, the only reason that they were able to get it done is because of a bilateral agreement. And they didn't have to invade anybody or undermine a government to make it happen, at least not to my knowledge. So in my opinion,
is that true with her views on Russia too, or?
Russia, similar situation, you know, I can't speak for her, but I can see that her policies and her rhetoric from the election definitely shows an understanding that, hey, Russia might be problematic, but it seems like almost everything they do has been in response to us, at least over the last decade. Even with the Ukraine situation from 2014, which she was, you know, she's completely evolved on since then because we were in the wrong. But basically, there was a consensus. With the Ukraine, we were about to arm neo-Nazis, which you are aware of, I'm sure.
Right, the Azov Battalion, yeah.
Exactly. We also, at that point, had control over their government, and we didn't like their, any of the opposition there, or obviously Russia, who knew, because that's their region, that the Clintons had installed that government. It was a very transactional relationship. And so, you know, I think in the reaction that Russia had to the Ukraine at the time was because of that relationship combined with the Ukraine working with the EU and I believe even the United States to freeze Russia out of some trade deal at the time. So it was like a reactionary thing where, of course, once again, it seemed like Russia, regardless of what you want to say about Putin, they seem to show more restraint when it comes to these issues than the United States does. Like, I just can't remember the last time, you know, in the last decade or since I've been paying attention to politics, that Putin authorized an extrajudicial assassination of a foreign leader on international soil. That's insanity to me. And I think that Tulsi recognizes that and has been trying and also recognizes that because when you recognize that you also know, of course, by necessity, Russia has shown that they are going to do what they have to protect themselves. They may not be the aggressor, but they're damn sure not going to let you just walk all over them. And so that's when you have to deal with this new Cold War situation that's clearly being fueled by this new neo-McCarthyism. So that seems to be a Tulsi stance on both situations is, why aren't we working to, you know, with these powerful nations to make sure that the plans and the policies and the international relations works for everybody instead of going straight to violence, oppression, suppression, sanctions, which all, as we all know, ultimately hurt the people rather than the leaders who were in charge at the time.
Now, you mentioned the arming of Ukrainian neo-Nazis. Was she supportive of that at the time? Was that something she's evolved on? What's going on there?
So at the time, I don't know if you remember, but the government were not recognizing these quote-unquote rebels as neo-Nazis. So this is something that Bernie supported, Tulsi supported. They got it wrong, in my opinion. Luckily, it never went through, because I guess Obama probably knew one of the good things that Obama did was never arming the neo-Nazis. and so it never went through. So, but she has evolved on that position since then and says, you know, we should not be arming other nations really at all. In her opinion, we should not be arming other nations in regional disputes because that ultimately undermines the United States national security.
Casey, I want to kick it over to you. Do you have anything you want to add in so far? Any comments?
I think Nico, you hit the nail on the head with regards to the institutional pressures against insurgent candidates like Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders, where the mainstream media, the DCCC, the DNC, mm-hmm. like every aspect of the cursus honorum of the Democratic Party is geared against not just these individuals, but anyone that doesn't eschew progressive values,
yeah.
Like AOC, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley.
Ilhan Omar is probably the only person who's gotten it, worse than Tulsi, because she's been getting it from both sides. At least the Trump people won't even touch Tulsi because they actually like her because they view her as authentic. But I just always think back to when they were calling Ilhan Omar anti-Semitic and the entire establishment converged on her. And it was disgusting to see, honestly. So, and we know that even if she would have said that as a neoliberal, what she had said, people would have been pissed, but they would have just made it about Israel first or something to that nonsense. It wouldn't have immediately become you're anti-Semitic. And we know that the implication is the assumption is she's anti-Semitic because she's Muslim. So that's why she feels that way. And that was not the case at all if you read the conversation. So, they usually, what they do, ironically enough, from what I've seen, is the identity politics they support, they only support them if they serve the ends or serve the means of Democrats, establishment Democrats. However, just as quickly, they will turn around and use your identity and all of the undertones, the negative undertones, the negative stereotypes against your identity. They'll use it against you immediately, whether it's your gender, whether it's your race, whether it's your ethnicity or your religion. We look at what Hillary Clinton did to Barack Obama in 2008. It was just disgusting. She sounded like Trump. You know, everybody wants to talk about what Trump used to say about Obama. People forget Obama and Hillary hated each other. And it was for a reason. Obama has not said anything. I mean, he said more negative stuff about Hillary since the election was over than he said damn near while he was campaigning. He hasn't said anything supportive about her or her campaign since, because they didn't really like each other. He was trying to protect his legacy, because if Bernie comes in right after Obama, you're going to realize just how bad of a president Obama really was. And he knew that. if you look at, I mean, just Tulsi, look at what they, oh, she was in a cult because she's Hindu. That was utterly disgusting. When you're looking at, I mean, the tropes against her. Oh, any young male or older male who prefers Tulsi to Bernie must only like her because of her looks, which is like, which is funny because she's like the most tomboyish presidential candidate that we've seen, even more so than the men sometimes. Like, she's a damn MMA fighter, like surfer, snowboarder, like plays basketball, all that good stuff. But they still use that sexist trope against her with AOC. How often do we see them kind of insult her with oh, you're just, you know, some bartender, you know, for female, some ditzy female from Brooklyn, that they would never use on an older establishment Democrat. They would never. They always defend them using those, their identities, rather than using those identities against them. So that's what, it's frustrating, because as a Black man in the progressive movement, you know, I see, and I was, you know, I was kind of ingratiated into the establishment Democrats back in the day. I knew what they wanted, and I kind of stayed away from it because I knew what time it was. But I see how people will only use our identities and our plight, you know, the things that we go through as marginalized people, when it benefits them. And although the neoliberals and the neocons really do this more than anybody else, the progressive movement, unfortunately, isn't exempt from that as well. And it's frustrating. It really is. But you hit the nail right on the head. When you don't fall in line, all of a sudden that identity that made you potentially an asset will be used against you, and it has been.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about how deeply ingrained the racist superstructure of America is for both of the largest, most powerful political parties to subtly or not so subtly endorse such systemic oppression against marginalized mm-hmm. groups. It just shows how in many ways the Democratic Party is the graveyard of progressive movements and all their stripes and colors.
Yeah, that's the best way. That's the best way to describe them.
I guess that's a good lead in to. I first off, I want to say I agree with you. I don't like this whole, you know, oh, you're only supporting Tulsi because you find her hot or whatever thing. I think all that, all of these, like, oh, she's a Russian agent, all of this stuff is just weak tea to me. What has concerned me, and you can, I'm going to give you the floor to counteract this, mm-hmm. but let me make this point. So the thing is with Tulsi Gabbard, of course, Steve Bannon has spoken to her, and that's one thing. I know...
Didn't speak to her. Spoken fondly of her. Yeah.
Okay. I know that Richard Spencer and David Duke have also spoken fondly of her. And even going back to 2016, I remember a lot of people, not necessarily even on the mainstream of the Republican right, but just people within far right wing circles who I, you know, was sort of following and monitoring. Their mm-hmm. two biggest politicians that they were interested in on the Democratic side of things were Tulsi Gabbard and mm-hmm. at the time he was running for president, Jim Webb. And to me, that sets off a lot of alarm bells. That concerns me. So I want to give you a chance to talk about the sort of far right trying to ingratiate themselves to Tulsi supporters.
So I'm not sure about the Richard Spencer thing. I do know about the David Duke thing, but she immediately, like, I think the moment he tweeted something out at the time, she shut him down immediately. So there's that. But you have to remember, too, as far as like Steve Bannon is concerned, Steve Bannon also likes Bernie. He actually was in a back and forth with Bill Maher defending Bernie, saying that, you know, he's just the most populist candidate. You know, that, you know, because at the end of the day, a lot of these people, whether or not their worldviews are different as far as what they would like to see at the end, they do know what is stopping them from achieving whatever personal agenda they want. So there's a populist left and there's also a populist right that Trump took advantage of. They both believe in fairer trade policies. They both believe in anti-interventionism, although some people would say for the populist right, they would call it isolationism. But, you know, at least you don't have wasteful regime change wars that hurt American lives. And that's ultimately what the populist right wants. And so you have people, most if not all the people who have expressed some type of support for Tulsi, not an endorsement, because neither David Duke did not endorse Tulsi, neither did Steve mm-hmm. Bannon. They just spoke fondly of her, specifically regarding regime change wars. And a lot of those people have said the same positive things about Bernie. And there's a reason for that. It's because when you are authentic, well, that can really reach across all political spectrums. We can disagree on a lot of things, but if you are an authentic person, then I know that our disagreements are not in bad faith. It simply means that we need to kind of work together, reach a compromise, and that our goals are likely the same, even if we want those goals for different reasons.
I guess in that regard, so what then sets Tulsi apart from that populist right? Because I understand she's against regime change wars, but is she a nationalist or is she an internationalist? Where does she sort of stand in your opinion? I know you can't speak for her.
No, yeah, I mean, for a situation like that, I'll still have the capacity. She doesn't mind. So basically, she doesn't like labels. I think that's a problem that Tulsi has probably had. It's beneficial in some regards, but people feel very uncomfortable with somebody that they can't put into a box. And that's the reality. That's what Tulsi brings to the table. Because, I mean, the truth of the matter is, and it's no offense to you guys, because I understand, like, it's just, you know, people are busy and if they don't see anything about it, they don't talk about it. But I get it. But if you've ever looked at Tulsi legislation, there's no way you could think she was part of the populist right. If the All Fossil Fuels Act is literally the most aggressive piece of legislation for climate change in history in any country, and that was her legislation, nobody from the populist right would introduce something like that. UBI, you know, Mitt Romney was the first Republican to even think about doing something like what he offered. And that was because Tulsi took on that mantle and demanded on Fox News that Trump push through UBI legislation if it got through, because she introduced it, and that his Republican colleagues supported it. The idea of universal health care, obviously not an idea that the populist right does like universal health care. I can't say that. But, you know, the idea of having mostly the government take care of everything else, you know, with exclusion of some supplementary coverage and maybe some nonprofit assistance, you know, that's not really a populist right idea, although they may support it in some capacity. Election integrity. She doesn't try to blame like voters for election integrity issues. That's what a lot of the populist right tries to do, right? It's, oh, we need them to have IDs. Oh, by the way, we're going to close all the DMVs prior to the election. No, she's not about that. She's about free and fair elections for everybody. And so you have to kind of look at her legislation and to understand where she is and what she feels on a given issue. You don't have to guess. You don't have to look at little sound bites and clips where people will try and cut up and they'll use that one clip, you know, and usually it's out of context to try and explain everything about Tulsi. I'm not saying I agree with her on literally everything. Like, even with maybe with Iran, she's a little more aggressive on Iran than I would like her to be. Although she is obviously pushing every way, form, or fashion to not go to war with Iran, would not blame Iran for anything that the Trump administration was trying to blame them for. She defended them. She's still a little bit more aggressive than I would like her to be. But I mean, at that point, I would say that most Democrats are more aggressive than what we would like them to be on Iran. But even though she had that little bit of aggression, is it like a populist right or person or politician to say, even despite my whatever you know, differences I may have with their government, we absolutely should not have any sanctions on them? That's not a populist right standpoint. In fact, Tulsi's better on sanctions than Bernie is. And you know, Bernie said during his interview with Kyle Kulinski that he would look in to potentially lifting sanctions on a few of these countries, the illegal sanctions, but he had not 100% committed, whereas Tulsi had committed 100% in the beginning of her campaign, even before that, saying that sanctions, you know, they've only hurt people. And she said this actually during my interview with her, said that they only hurt people, they never hurt the government. That's not the way we should go about handling our business. So she separates herself in a lot of ways. It's just weird that people ultimately went to categorize her as a quote unquote, you know, maybe part of the populist right or even a nationalist. But I think that a lot of that was disingenuous, if I'm being honest with you. There were a lot of Bernie supporters who started the whole, because it wasn't the neoliberals saying she was a nationalist. They had a lot of other colorful names for her. But that was oftentimes progressives who were predominantly Bernie supporters, if I'm being quite frank. I'm not saying that those are Bernie supporters in good faith, and nor am I saying that they are representative of the entire Bernie support base. But what I am saying is that there was this fear, this reality that Bernie would have some of his weaknesses exposed if Tulsi was able to enter into the progressive movement as a presidential candidate and have her message heard and being taken seriously. So what we saw instead was this attempt to create and sow distrust, so that no matter what her message was, you would see it through the lens that, oh, well, she's just a nationalist. She's a pop. Like, I remember this situation happened with I guess one of her videos that she did with Dave Rubin on immigration, like a clip from that. And she said that according to what was being said on the debate stage that night here in Miami, you would think that everybody, all the Democrats on that stage were for open borders. Effectively, they are not, but they were pandering. And that was the point she was making. Because we know that if you would have looked at that debate stage and the night after, you would have thought that almost all the Democrats were for single-payer health care, for Medicare for all. But you and I both know that wasn't the case. They were pandering. But if you would have went on to then listen to the rest of her stance, she had the exact same stance as Bernie. It's the exact same stance, except for she takes it a step further and then breaks down how the military-industrial complex contributes considerably to our immigration situation. So when people were trying to lob these titles at her, nationalist, isolationist, whatever you want to call it, it was just for the same reason, unfortunately, that the neoliberals would do it. They never actually look at her legislation. They never actually look at her policies. All these people say they're about policy, but they never actually look at her policies that she's already introduced. So you don't have to guess where she stands on certain things. They say, well, there was this clip one time 5 years ago. And I'm like, okay, by that standard, I could do the same thing with Bernie, because everybody always says, well, why did Bernie vote for the 94 crime bill? And I usually let it slide, but just for, you know, just for parody's sake, I'll explain it. But I usually let it slide. He'll say it's what, for the Violence Against Women's Act. That's a talking point. And people accept talking points from Bernie because it's Bernie, except for that's not true. Bernie supported the crime bill. He used crime as the reason he supported the crime bill. There is a clip of Bernie going into detail about how much he supports the crime bill. And it's honestly sickening, because if you read the crime bill, you know, back then they got away with it because people didn't really have access, nor did they have a desire to see that type of legislation. It's different now. We can go back and see it. And you can see that they knew they could get away with it because the bill would make you sick to your goddamn stomach if you read it. And Bernie still supported it. And claiming that, oh, it's because of the Violence Against Women's Act. And that was actually a whole ass lie. And he knew it was a lie, but he kind of took advantage of the fact that people just trusted in him and that people wouldn't go back and verify it. And it's crazy that the neoliberals actually never came out and called him on that. But it's lucky, I guess, for the movement. But it's also, it's kind of like this disingenuous thing where people say, well, I just don't trust Tulsi. I just don't trust her. But it's like, okay, so why do you then trust Bernie holistic? I don't trust any politician 100%, period. I don't give a damn if it's Tulsi or Bernie, and I like both of them. But there's definitely been an unfair standard applied to Tulsi, and some of that has been self-serving. And that's why I think, and because of the far-reaching audiences that a lot of these people have, those popular opinions became the norm. And it just sucks because we haven't really been able to see in a large capacity anyway the conversations we're having here today, where we actually get down to the nitty gritty. Because if, for example, I'm sure you're probably friends with Michael Brooks. I have a lot of disagreements with him. I believe it or not, I actually like a lot of his commentary. I think that he is, for the most part, a very good guy. But I have a problem with some of his disingenuous smears of Tulsi that he knows are disingenuous, but then he only brings people on to capitalize on the fear mongering that has already been done and the smears that have already been inseminated into people's minds, rather than bringing on an opinion that differentiates from yours. Not saying you gotta like the opinion, not saying I agree with the opinion, but how are we doing justice to the movement by ostracizing allies, by spreading, by seeding distrust? It's not like you're, once again, it's not policies we're talking about. Because I've already talked to you about our policies. We're talking about seeding distrust, saying, I can't trust this young woman of color that is not from a mainstream religion. for no other reason than a couple of sound bites. Whereas for Bernie, it's like, well, I just trust him. Well, what about all these other things that he showed that maybe be a little bit skeptical of trusting him in certain situations? And they'll say, well, no, that's different though, because Bernie's the only chance we have to win. Sorry. Go ahead.
Nico, what I was going to say, there's a very specific reason I brought up the point about nationalism. And I want to give you something first before we go forward with that. I want to say, first, a lot of people bring up, when it comes to the war against terrorists, I'm a hawk. And that's the Tulsi quote. But what people leave out is she also said, when it comes to counterproductive wars, a regime change, I'm a dove.
Yes.
I guess, so I want to
appreciate
give you that.
You bringing that up, by the way.
Yeah. What concerns me is I feel like Tulsi's rhetoric with regards to her anti-war stance is usually framed in a sort of America first framework. And maybe that's useful. Maybe that brings more people to her side. But I just worry that will attract the wrong kind of sort of nationalist fervor into her corner. And I'm just very uncomfortable with that nationalistic sentiment. Not that I necessarily think she believes in that nationalism. I don't know.
I don't think it's a nationalist sentiment. I think it's like she just recognizes the country that she's running to be president of, right? So it's like maybe if a lot of the Republicans are neocons who have, unfortunately, the reality situation is they've been perfectly fine with us just going over and killing innocent people. So she can't play on their emotions, the sentimental reality of what our government has done and our military has done to a lot of those people overseas. So what she then instead leads with so that she can help, so she can gain the attention of people who would otherwise ignore a leftist, she says, look, this is actually undermining our national security. Your daughter, your brother, your sister, your husband, your wife are putting themselves in danger, with that United States uniform on for some rich man's war. And then all of a sudden, for a populist person on the populist right, it clicks. And now they're willing to listen to everything else you have to say. And so I've seen Tulsi in person convert Republicans into not necessarily Democrats, but at least becoming independent minded. And I've seen her convert Trumpers in real time. Wow, I didn't think about that. And all of a sudden, when she speaks from that perspective, because she's not running to be the president of anybody else's country, she's running to be the president of this country. And when you are running for president of this country and you're trying to, because you have to eventually run the general election, you have to just remind people, look, maybe you don't care about what's going on in those people's lives over there, but understand it's affecting you, your family, your friends more here than you realize. That's not nationalism. I think that's just understanding what country you're running in, because she always talks about the innocent lives that are lost there. She always talks about the fact, if she says that, you know, something about, well, it's undermining America's security and we're spending the money that over there fighting a war we don't need to be in, when we could be taking care of Americans right here at home. And that type of rhetoric, it may not be, it may be innocuous to a lot of people. It may set off some alarm bells for people like us, maybe. And it, you know, somewhat did for me in the beginning before I actually started doing my research and talking to her. But it may be innocuous, maybe, you know, might set off some alarms for somebody like us. But for populist right people, they're like, oh, well, that's different. That's different. But she's advocating for the same thing. It's peace. It is mutually beneficial peace. But certain rhetoric affects certain people differently. That's why, once again, in my opinion, I look at the legislation. When all else fails, maybe for everybody, like for Warren, you can't really figure out if she's full of shit or not, because she's like the most the most unproductive or second most unproductive senator in the Senate. Okay, so no, she wasn't. But for some, she's a little bit more harder to figure out, because she would act populist sometimes, and then she would always point to the CFPB. But because people didn't know, because she didn't introduce the CFPB like as a legislator, and people didn't realize that the CFPB was actually just a Trojan horse, or it was used to bring in the new Dodd-Frank as a Trojan horse, and so nobody would pay attention to it because you're so excited about the CFPB. So they didn't know. They've been kind of reliant on the assumption that the CFPB was altruistic and that it's doing its job the way that it was pitched to be doing its job. But after that, there's not really a lot of legislation for Warren. Tulsi, that's not the case. Bernie even, that's not the case. I remember she used, you know, when Warren used to say, I have a plan for that. And we would all laugh. We're like, oh, that's funny, because if you're looking at Tulsi or Bernie, they got bills for that. And we don't have to figure out what her intentions are necessarily when you can look at the legislation. We don't have to ask what she meant by, well, I'm a Warren, you know, I'm a hawk. By the way, when it comes to colloquial language, Tulsi is not good at it. She's Hawaiian. They have a whole different world. She takes things way too literal. I get on her about it all the time. I'm going to tell you a joke. One time, I said, we were having a text message conversation, and I said, the acronym IDPOL for identity politics. She said, oh, one thing though, what's IDPOL? She had no idea what I was talking about. Cause that's the type of quirky person she is. She's a nerd to a large degree. She loves Game of Thrones. Like, she's just one of those type of people that like just really started interacting heavily on social media and picking up a lot of this lingo as she was running for president. So sometimes when she said she was a hawk, she thought like, yeah, I mean, I'm a hawk and stopping it from happening. I don't know what else you thought that would mean. But if you were curious of how she meant that, well, then you start looking up legislation. You find out in 2015, she tried to actually end the war in Syria in 2015. Before everybody else was privy to what was going on there, she was trying to end that war. And that was in my opinion, the more neoliberal, you know, time in her career. You look at the No More Presidential Wars Act. What she means is, I'm going to cut off all ties from the United States to the military industrial complex, and then we'll see what happens. But she clearly showed what she meant by being a hawk, as in, I am not going to stop introducing legislation. I'm not going to stop talking about this issue until it is dealt with. And that, in my opinion, if she wants to be a hawk in that regard, we need more of them. But when it comes to just trying to start a war or trying to start, you know, some type of violent altercation, you know, thinking that that's the solution for everything. No, she doesn't support that. She's the only one, at least before she dropped out, she was actually the only one who voted against all of Trump's military budgets. And Bernie said that, but it was actually he misspoke, because he was campaigning, but he missed one of them. He missed the vote against one of them. And it was the most recent one, whereas Tulsi actually was there for it and actually initially got her No More Presidential Wars Act pushed through. But unfortunately, the Democrats, believe it or not, was the ones who took it out. Yeah, I know, that's ridiculous. But everybody claims they want to hold Trump accountable. But yeah, the moral of the story is, when all else fails, look up the legislation. And once you see that, you'll figure it out really quick who's on your team and who's not.
I just want to ask you one more thing, and then I'll give Casey time to ask one or two questions if you have the time. Mm-hmm. The other big thing that I've wanted to talk about in regards to Tulsi, I know you mentioned Hindu phobia. I guess there's a lot of talk about Tulsi being too close with Narendra Modi, mm-hmm. the Prime Minister of India. What are your thoughts on that? Because it does make me uncomfortable knowing some of India's history when it comes to Muslims.
I don't think that, first of all, this idea that she's too close to Modi is kind of weird, because she's like, she's not as close to Modi as most of our politicians, even the progressive ones, unfortunately, are to Imran Khan, right? Mm-hmm. Imran Khan literally boasts about terrorists in Kashmir by way of Pakistan, and people seem to be fine with it. I think that she, like with most leaders, any leader that has reached out to Tulsi to try and, you know, conduct peace talks, or in India's case, when Modi got elected, Obama had basically tasked her with repairing the relationship that the Republicans ruined with Modi. Because some background information, Modi was considered in Gujarat a populist, and he was fighting against Republicans and Westerners coming in and basically buying off all the Hindus and all the Muslims and turning them Christian. Because we all know, if you know anything about the history of colonialism, what's the first way you colonize, quote unquote, even if it's unofficially a country? You convert them, you know, you know, by force, or, you know, by payoff. And that's what was happening. And so Narendra Modi was actually fighting this. And the Republicans at the time introduced legislation to try and demonize him. And so people don't even know. The beef with Modi actually started with Republicans. He was an enemy. Why? Because Narendra Modi likes single-payer health care. Public bathrooms were brought in because of Modi, you know, various things. So whether or not you disagree with him or agree with him, it was actually Obama who tasked out Tulsi to repair that relationship because they knew India was on the way to being one of the world's largest economies. And of course, they did end up becoming the fastest growing economy in the world over several years. And so that relationship, quote unquote, that is not really all that big of a deal. You know, not as much as what people make it. It was a diplomatic one as someone who sat on the Committee of Foreign Affairs. You know, like, oh, wow, we have our first Hindu in Congress. Let's put her to good use. Let's see if we can benefit from the country. That's it. It's just a diplomatic relationship. And, you know, I don't want to get into all the India politics. I know it's a touchy situation that people literally just started caring about for whatever reason 8 months ago. But I will say this. Let's just say that Modi was the worst person in the world. Let's just assume that to be true. And that he's committing violent acts every single day, which, by the way, he as a president actually has less power than our president does, because they have a better democracy and checks and balance system than we do. But let's just say he was just this crazy dictator and fascist like everybody says he is. Do we actually believe that demonizing him more so, saying we're never going to talk to you, we're never going to work with you, is going to actually be more beneficial for the people that he's affecting or less? Or having someone that, even if you can only relate to them through religion, right? Yoga, because he's a big yoga guy, started International Yoga Day in India. And that's something that he and Tulsi have in common. Wouldn't it be better if you could send somebody like Tulsi in who may disagree with him, but has the best chance of reaching some type of commonality and say, look, you gotta, if we want to help your country, you want to help your country, work with us, help these people, don't hurt them. And let's see if we can make some positive change together. That FDR had to make deals with Stalin, you know, like, I'm sure they didn't always like each other, but they liked each other a little, probably more than they should have. But they weren't the best of friends. They probably didn't have the same ideology. But when you have to get diplomacy done, you got to get it done, because when you don't, the people suffer.
I think that's fair enough. The only thing I'll add is I do think there are some people that have only become interested in things like the BJP. In the past 8 months, I myself do find what has gone on in Kashmir troubling. I think there's a lot of tensions between the Hindu population and the Muslim population in India that are worth talking about. So I don't want to say that it's all just the past 8 months and people wanting to go against Tulsi.
Well, no,
I think there are real issues there.
So when I say caring, I mean, it was never a major political issue in the States in our presidential electoral dialogue until we had a Hindu run. And then people perceived, and it was weird the way it was happening, because the neoliberals kind of sparked that conversation to try and attack Tulsi over it. And then the progressives have focused so much on Tulsi, actually, funny enough, that they never made the connection that Kamala actually loves Modi and is friends with Modi and is welcome Modi. And that should have kind of been like, hold up. So why is it that they care about stuff that he's doing supposedly now, but they didn't care if he was a fascist? He didn't just become a fascist yesterday. If he was a fascist, he's been like this.
Modi also just met with Trump, and that didn't get nearly as much coverage as the—
You would have thought it would. Now, right. Granted, once again, he should, because he's a leader of a nation and Trump is a leader of a nation. And what also doesn't get talked about is the fact that even though he met with Trump, there was both Democrats, Republicans present. There were Punjabs, Hindus and Muslims all present. The tensions between Hindus and Muslims in that region are very real. And unfortunately, the reality of the situation is those tensions are very real, mostly because of, once again, the fuck-ups of Western imperialism. The British left India and even Pakistan and Bangladesh and Kashmir. They left them broken. They did some half-assed job annexing and drawing the maps there. And unfortunately, left a bunch of Muslims in India that would have probably preferred to be in Kashmir. And they left a lot of Hindus in Kashmir. But the reality of the situation is the tensions are high all across the board, because you know, the Muslim population in India has actually grown substantially. And since, you know, the whole thing went down. But the reality of the situation is in Kashmir, you know, the Hindu population has almost become completely eliminated. And that's not necessarily because, quote unquote, bad or good Muslims hate Hindus in that region. It just means that the people who are in charge were very suppressive and oppressive. And so that region has there. It's very complex. But I also am not one of those people that likes to try and dictate how we should go about. And I'm once again, I'm a pragmatist. I understand that people get emotionally caught up in this type of stuff, but I'm a pragmatist. And so I'm thinking solutions all the time. And I don't think a solution is to say, Modi's bad, never talk to him, never be friends with him. Because if he was all the evil things that we are claiming he is, then what does that mean for the people if the one person or the one country that has the power to not only use our power, but other measures as well to stop that, what good does it do if we do not engage in diplomacy and speak to him and see if we can do something about it?
The only other thing I would add to that is when it comes to the India-U.S. relationship, a lot of people forget. Ultimately, when you look at the Gallup polls for world affairs, Americans find a country like India, they view it very favorably. I believe it's the sixth favorite nation in the world perceived by Americans. So there's I think there's more of a consensus around support of India that goes way beyond Tulsi. Maybe that's the bigger issue in a lot of ways. Before we close out, Casey, I want to give you the chance to respond to anything since I know you didn't get to say as much during this conversation.
No, I think you both pretty much covered all that really could be said. Well, I have criticisms from like an internationalist perspective, and I'm not really going to comment on Stalin and FDR.
Yeah, I know. Trust me, we can have a whole nother podcast about that whole World War II situation.
that's a whole struggle session that we can put off for a different time. But no, I don't have any additional questions. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, Nico, I want to thank you for coming on. I'm glad we could keep it very cordial. I know I've had guests on that you've debated before, and sometimes it can get very heated. I'm glad we could keep it clean. I appreciate that.
Look, ultimately, the reason I like to have debates, because some people think that, which is weird, because back in the day, like if you look at like Lincoln and Douglas, first of all, I don't know if people know, that debate actually was not supposed to happen because Douglas did not want to debate Lincoln because he knew that Lincoln was a great debater. But Douglas back then knew, oh, if you didn't want to debate, it's because you're disingenuous. It's because you have something to hide. It's because you don't understand the issues. And me being a debater by trade, if you will, doing it since I was a freshman, I know when someone is opinionated that they're trying to be taken seriously for whatever personal agenda. And of course, I'm opinionated and I'm trying to have my opinion taken seriously too for whatever agenda that I want. And so if we both feel like our opinions are valuable, I don't see what could possibly be lost if we engage in a debate in good faith. You know, maybe, hell, most times if the debate's, you know, civil, then you end up, the entire audience leaves with more respect and more knowledge than they came in with for all the parties involved. And that's why I feel like we shouldn't be avoiding people we disagree with, especially if they consider themselves a progressive, especially if they consider themselves a leftist. Because how else are you supposed to bridge those gaps and find solutions? Because I don't know everything about everything. You know, Ben is very intelligent. He doesn't know everything about anything either or about everything either. And that's the only way we can learn more is by having these type of conversations rather than and once again, being fairly critical of everybody. If you're a journalist, maybe you're not a journalist and that's a different discussion, but we should also still think critically of everybody we support or don't support. We shouldn't assume somebody is everything somebody does is great just because we support them, just like we shouldn't assume everything done by like somebody like Trump is horrible just because we support them. You know, if Bernie went to North Korea to try and denuclearize that situation and make peace with Kim Jong-un, boy, we would be shouting that shit from the rooftops, right? And we shouldn't pretend like just because Trump did it, that it was a bad thing like the neoliberals did. So that's what I think, you know, that's just, you know, some final words in that department. But I appreciate you guys and what you're trying to do here by bringing on, you know, different voices.
real quick, I want to give you a chance. And again, thank you for coming on, Parallaxes. I want to give you a chance to let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Niko, N-I-K-O, C-S, F as in Frank, and B. You can find me on YouTube at the MCSE Network with Niko House. You can also find me on a new alternative platform that I've been a part of that's pretty damn good, if I may say so myself, called Rockfin, rokfin.com/Niko. And there's a lot of other good progressives and moderates on there as well that do some great work. So I would strongly encourage you to look into rockfin.com, whether you are a viewer or a creator.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Niko House. I have to say, I'm not sold on Tulsi Gabbard. That's just my opinion, though, and I'd love to hear yours. Please feel free to drop me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. If you'd like to share your thoughts about Tulsi Gabbard, where do you stand? Do you think progressives should have put their weight behind her rather than Bernie Sanders? Or should they have put weight behind both? Let me know what you think. I'd be very interested. Like I said, I have my own biases, but I wanted to give Niko a bit of a hearing. There's some things that still trouble me, like I said, mainly the stuff with India, and also the sort of playing footsie with elements of the right that I think could lead to some ramifications in the future. Those are sort of the concerns I brought up in this conversation. There's probably others that I failed to mention in the course of our conversation. We were limited on time, so forgive me for that. Maybe Niko will come back for a more, I don't know, adversarial debate next time. I would really like that. I need to hone up on my debate skills. I'm so used to the interview format. Anyways, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. You can hear some archived editions of classic Parallax Views programs there, as well as the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was. And I've been behind on that one just because of all the coronavirus pandemic insanity going on right now. I really need to get out a new episode, but I've been so focused on getting out new timely episodes on the main feed regarding the coronavirus pandemic that I've been lagging woefully behind. And hopefully you will forgive me for that. As I have said, you can still get these great archived editions of Parallax Views classic programs on Patreon when I'm not releasing a current events program, when I'm not releasing a new edition of The Week That Was. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I'm I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.